Hey, I'm Dan Brophy, and welcome to the Quit Your Day Job podcast. It's a podcast for frustrated creatives. So each week, I like to talk about the practical, pragmatic tools and tips associated with taking your dreams and turning them into a reality. It's all about how to take realistic steps towards turning what you love into what you do. And this week, I'm speaking to two creatives who I think are arguably two of the most prolific creatives working across film, TV, radio, stand-up comedy, and stage musicals, all of which they have written, directed, and starred in. I don't know two 20-somethings who are more prolific or more hardworking, certainly not in their 20s in Australia. It's Hannah and Eliza Riley, who some of you may know from ABC shows like Growing Up Gracefully or Sheila's, or their shows at Belvoir Theatre like Yarra Madoon. Hannah previously used to host the Sexpert show, The Hookup, on Triple J. She's recently started a foray into stand-up comedy. The girls have been writing scripts that they've been now shopping around through HBO and adventures overseas in the US. Never before have I been more impressed with the output, but also the process behind the output, as I've noticed with Hannah and Eliza. And I wanted to sit down with them for some time because every time I check in with them socially, they seem to be working on something else really dynamic or interesting, or winning some award or hosting some major award ceremony. And I think of all the themes that emerged throughout this episode, the power of partnership has really become apparent, because the idea of duplicating or amplifying your effectiveness by partnering up with someone who has a slightly different skill set to your own is something I've been interested in for a while, because the idea that you could put twice as many hours towards something if you had two people working on it instead of one, both aligned with the same goal, both coming at it from slightly different perspectives and bringing different skill sets to the table, I think is the theme that emerged for me over the course of the discussion with Hannah and Eliza, which is the thing that allows them to have been able to do so much in only a couple of years. But I also realized that this has been the work of very many more years behind the scenes, and it's great for people who are listening to be reminded that it does take a long time to achieve your dreams. I've said before, you know, to become a lawyer or a doctor or a highly specialized anything in the world, it takes years worth of study, and study is basically just practice. So even if you're not studying your craft in a academic sense, why would you take less than 5 to 10 years to become one of the best in your field in a creative area? And even if you're not aspiring to be the best in your field, but you just want to be good enough to sell a skill, then that takes time and study and specificity and dedication. And what I came to discover when it comes to the process of Hannah and Eliza Riley is that they have been gravitating towards this process for nearing 10 years now. They have been volunteering in radio, they have been establishing their voice as creatives, they've been establishing a system of working together that has then allowed them to be so effective in how they do what they do now. I'm interested in the idea that it's one thing to have a talent, and it's another thing altogether to have a talent for your talent, so that you can learn how to market it and to manifest more of it and to become more effective in your maneuvering of your talent in a day-to-day capacity. I wanted to talk to the girls about how they work every day, how they structure their days, what their mornings look like, what their routine looks like in order to be effective and still have creative inspiration while having such a huge output. And I think this is a really good conversation for anyone who's looking to start a creative partnership, because it's really good to have not only a shared vision with the person that you want to be collaborating with, but also to have a slightly different background or skill set, so that you're not just doubling up on what you're both bringing to the table, but you're duplicating and amplifying what you're capable of doing, because you are bringing the worth and the experience and the expertise of two humans to the table for one shared vision. And maybe your partnership will be more than two. It could be three or four if you're looking to write something really elaborate like a TV series. But in terms of just doing the day-to-day, being able to trust that your creative partner has your back and knowing that you are moving towards shared goals together is a great way to get the job done. And it also keeps you accountable. It's almost like exercising with a team or working out with a personal trainer. You're less likely to cop out if you're accountable to the group. And I think something about having a running mate that is stirring you on to do more when otherwise you might cop out is another great way to make sure you are being as effective as possible. If you find this episode worthwhile or entertaining or engaging or inspiring, please share it with someone who may find it similarly inspiring. And it could also be that you want to share it with someone who you want to enter into a partnership with, whether it be on a little project or a trial basis or something that you'd like to maybe experiment with the idea of making something together. This could be the conversation that inspires you to do that. So this is a great opportunity for you to copy the link of the podcast and share it. It could be the thing that begins your next great creative endeavor. Well, without further ado, please enjoy my chat with Hannah and Eliza Riley, two of my favorite creatives. And this conversation is one that I like to call the power of creative partnership. Enjoy.
I'd love a top-up of Sand Hilly.
Oh, I've always wanted to be sponsored by Sand Hilly. Oh, maybe this is my...
Of course,
Oh, my goodness.
It's the taste of the Mediterranean, right? It's the Amalfi Coast in the cup. Well,
amazing.
Okay, well, I like to start by asking people, when someone says, what do you do, what do you tell them?
Well, I would probably stutter through a whole bunch of different answers, but now we've learnt from going to LA, we've heard there's a term for what we do, which is called multi-hyphenates.
But I would never use that.
What would you say?
Like Eliza, I would stutter for 30 seconds. And honestly, the answer would... I change the answer depending on who's asked the question. You know what I mean?
Because immigration, the cops.
Yes, exactly. My parents. So
that's a great one. Okay, well, what about a parent's friend? What would you say you do?
I would just try and keep it simple and say that I'm a writer.
Yeah. You want to keep it very simple. But really, in my heart, I would say that I'm a creator across different platforms.
Yeah, but I would be hesitant to use the word create myself because then they'd be like, creator.
Exactly,
what?
Yeah. And when you're talking to your parents' friends, make it really, I'm a writer. Today, I'm a writer.
What about someone who hadn't seen you for 10 years who had been living overseas?
Oh, I would say I run my own production company with Hannah and we make theater, TV, and features, and we are mostly in what we make.
That is great. That summarizes as far as I understand what you do. Yeah. What you do. That's okay, that makes perfect sense. Well, we're midway through 2019. I feel like the last 2 years for you guys has been pretty action-packed. And I think maybe since Life After Sheila's, although maybe that was even longer than 2 years ago. Growing Up Gracefully was the beginning of...
Kind of, yeah. Like, this was our first television project together.
We actually made Sheila's before Growing Up Gracefully and had to sit on this complete, fully ready-to-go episode for a year and a half, 18 months before we released it.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, for those who don't know, because we actually have international guests, international listeners who are listening to us from, like, the UK and Canada and the States and a little bit of Brazil... Who knows why? I do very well.
Oh my goodness! I bet you do.
So, but for those who don't know what you've been working on, what the TV work is the beginning that a lot of people in our orbit would have seen you guys. What were the shows that you were working on in the last couple of years?
Well, I guess we kind of started working together on radio where we hosted a show called Girls Gone Mild. And it was kind
Mild
of...
Mild. M.
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 Our but dad Googled...
International.
Yeah, dad tried to Google it and it automatically filled it out to Wild. And then he just kind of came into the room looking quite pale, wondering why we've named our show that. Yeah, so it was kind of like a magazine comedy show where we get comedians on, and we kind of had the freedom to do whatever we wanted.
Which radio station?
FBI. It's this awesome community radio station in Sydney. It's kind of the biggest community radio station in Australia. It's kind of the beating heart of cultural Sydney. And a comedy producer heard us on radio one day and was like, are you interested in making television? And we were like, yes. And
what age were you guys when you were doing the show?
It was from year 12 in high school, so we would have been like 17, 18 until our like really early 20s. Great. And that was even starting out doing like 1 till 6 a.m. radio shifts, like leaving house parties and having to go do radio and stuff, which is really fun.
Are you guys the same age?
We're 13 months apart.
And who's older? And was there, whose idea was it to do a radio show?
I think I started volunteering there first, and yeah, it was like
they had auditions, and it was just naturally.
We already were doing lots of stuff together in drama at high school, and we
long time collaborators since the early 90s. So.
Yeah, and so we just started from there, but from radio. We've done a lot in the last couple of years. We've written an original comedy musical that was on at a really small but prestigious theatre called Belvoir Street Theatre in Sydney, which was amazing last year. And
is actually where our parents met at the theatre.
Our parents met.
And that they were both actors.
No, our dad was a producer and mum was an actress.
That old story.
Yes, I know.
Wouldn't happen these days.
No, marry a producer or die trying.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I say. And now I'm a producer, so...
Yeah.
And then we've done TV shows that are a bit more on sort of networks, and we've done multi-platform series, which is Sheila's, and... Now we're kind of moving more into long form narrative scripted drama comedies.
Yeah.
And that is in our adventure to the US, which has been amazing to try and start a new part of the journey over there as well.
I love that, because let's talk about, so now, you know, there are so many things that are happening for you at this time in terms of just lots of fingers and lots of pies and lots of platforms that you're making work on. But I do love the idea of what that origins looks like, because I think when you do start, when you just look at the work now, people go, oh, how would you even do that? Too hard basket, I don't understand. But I do love the idea of the fact that you guys were just students schlepping through the midnight to 6 a.m. shift on community radio, which is also a nice way to go, you know, you're not 21, 22, you've been working at that for 7 or 8 years. I mean, how long ago was the midnight shift on the radio?
I would say that would have been in, I guess, like 2010, which is like the year after we finished high school. And yeah, we were doing
it in high school, though. I remember coming to school and thinking I was so cool. It was so cool, and it was really cool. Yeah. But it was really
all our
fun.
Friends would constantly just be texting us, be like, "Give us a shout out."
Yeah. So that's a good top line idea of what you've been doing in the last couple of years. I feel like the last 2 years have been pretty nonstop, pretty jam packed. But in terms of where you guys came from in order to have that success, because the thing about this podcast, which I love, is I speak to people at varying degrees of success or within various stages of their process, and I do love the idea that it does really focus on the journey to getting there from usually very traditional beginnings. You know, everyone's usually somewhere between like a post-high school, did a uni, started to experiment post-uni, maybe had a detour off down a path that they felt wasn't them, and then came back into doing something that meant something. But it sounds like you guys didn't have to have a corporate existential crisis in order to realize that this is what you really wanted to invest your energy in.
Yeah, I mean, we were lucky enough to grow up with two parents who are also in show business, and we kind of it was sort of in many ways inevitable for us, just in the kind of household that we grew up in. It would have been a huge deviation if either one of us was like, oh, maybe you want to be a lawyer, or maybe you want to be
a
dentist. They would have loved it.
They would have loved that. They would have been so relieved. I'm sure they'd sleep very well at night.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's also really nice that our family can share in the experience of what it's like to try and forge a career in show business, and our parents get very invested in what we're doing in our work, but it's also a really nice way of connecting with them because they know exactly the kind of stuff that we've been through. Whereas I can imagine if maybe you're a parent who's a lawyer and you have a kid who's trying to make it in show business and they come like crying to you about some sort of failure, it'd be hard to understand just how like heartbreaking or the different kind of struggles that you can go through. But our parents just, they totally get it, which is really nice.
Well, yeah,
it's like it's not a meritocracy in the same way that other industries are. Mm-hmm. You know, you can apply yourself to the what you think is the right way to progress your career and still not have what it takes or be able to be in the right place at the right time. Or there's a lot of variables that are out of your control.
I think we're really lucky that we were allowed to declare that that's what we wanted to do and have that. And I understand lots of people feel pressure to kind of give the other thing a go before you go into the dream. Make sure, just do it. Just do it for a couple of years. Just finish the degree, have it as a back pocket. And we, like, I don't think much credit comes from within myself personally. It's totally growing up in an environment where you were allowed to not have a backup. And essentially it's growing up with the thing of, if you do have a backup, that's the wrong attitude towards getting what you want. You know, like you can't, there are no backups because it's, you don't have time to have a backup. Essentially, you've got to go for it. And if there is any backup, do the backup full time.
Yeah. And we're incredibly lucky that we come from our parents and our sort of, we have so many privileges that they are able to support us and they didn't, you know.
All their friends are artists. Yes. Like we grew up amongst artists and I guess that exactly going back to your question about merit-based career, I think that our parents are, or our community and we are very proud about just doing good work.
We're just working hard. I think our parents were like, we will support you endlessly as long as we can see that you're really working hard. Like, you can't take the piss.
Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? You're not resting on your laurels.
Yeah.
You are actually working your butt off and you're producing good work. And whether that is all for naught, that no one else has to acknowledge it, but as long as we can, we know within ourselves that we're doing it. I think that's the I think that's the merit in a meritless, sometimes based sector.
What does working hard look like? Is it a time? Is it a time delivery? Is it a result delivery? Is it a pages delivery?
I think that for us, we are navigating that because that is full of ego, hard work. I think for us in our definition right now, it means time. How much time, but I also at the same time don't believe that either. It's smarter, not harder. And this idea of, you know, the person with the most sweat and blood and tears on their face wins and they're the hardest worker. And I don't believe that's true, but sometimes your ego and the panic sets in and you just think that the harder you go, the better the work. And that's the most tricky. But for, I think right now, hard work means how many sacrifices you have to make, how many parties you can't go to, how many normal 20 something things you can no longer do because you're putting everything, priority number one is this journey, really. Do you reckon?
Yeah, I think so. But it also just makes me think of, like, I guess, like we were saying before, there can be a danger of this attitude where you're sort of like placing your worth on the outcome of your work and like you're placing your value on how hard you're working, and it might not necessarily mean that the work gets any better or that you feel any more fulfilled, but as long as it feels hard, then it's worthwhile. Like, and I think that's a real trap that you can fall into. If like, if you're struggling, then you're rewarded for that, which I think...
Yes, yeah, that's a good point about being like, you can... It feels... either actually working hard or appearing to be working hard on something. It's like almost a strange pressure valve, because if it doesn't work out, at least the people around you and you know that you worked really hard. So it's kind of like this, almost like this, but I worked really hard. And you, of course you did. It's just not that great, but that's okay, because you worked hard in a kind of way. But
And it's also at the end of the day, like, I feel like it's important to remind ourselves when we try and do this regularly, and I know I certainly try and remind myself of this regularly, that no matter how hard you're working, if I had another job, I would be doing this for free. So no matter how hard things seem and how much of a grind it seems, you really just have to take a step back and be like, what, literally what we do to make money is to create stories and have fun. Like, that is our job. And that is an insane, ridiculous way to earn a living. It's bonkers. So it's kind of... I always find that thought a just nice pressure release to be like, at the end of the day, you're not working in a fucking salt mine, like, relax. You know what I mean?
You're not saving lives.
Yeah.
No disrespect to the salt mine.
Yeah. It's a lot easier than that. You know what I mean?
They have a right to complain.
Yeah, they have a right to talk about hard work. Like, we get to play for work. You know what I mean?
I've never heard you say it like that. But I would also counter that a lot of people that we know get themselves into complete sort of guilt-ridden cycles where they feel completely spoilt and unworthy to be put in the position where they only get to do the greatest thing for their job. So then they're like really, really flogging themselves, really trying to do it because they feel like there's got to be a catch somewhere in a way.
I was listening to the salt mine analogy. It was reminding me of a Seth Godin analogy that he made on a Doing Good Work book that I was reading of his, which is, if your job is to dig a ditch, every day you'll turn up, put on the uniform, and for X amount of hours a day, your job is to dig the ditch. You don't think, oh, am I really in the mood to do it? Even if I do it, it won't be that great, so I'm not going to do it today anyway. Or, oh, look, you know, I think if I just wait till tomorrow to do the ditch, I think it'll be a much better ditch. You've locked in for 8 hours and you're digging a ditch, so turn up and do it. And my attitude since hearing that has been towards my creative work has been
dig the ditch. Yeah.
Just dig the fucking ditch. Because it's not up to you to put a value on whether how beautifully the ditch is dug. Mm-hmm. It's up to you to just dig the fucking ditch.
I heard somebody talk about creators, in this instant TV writers, about this idea of, you know, sometimes the expectation is that you won't see something for many, many months or perhaps years. And that is a completely fine and okay understanding to have sometimes. So they kind of describe it like the ocean is full of water, but then if you put any shaped vessel into the water and bring it out, the water's going to fit that vessel. So if you tell a writer, you've got till tomorrow night, suddenly, like, it's amazing. It's amazing how it happens. And just sort of, it is that sort of, starting our journeys in radio and also in TV, which had a very, very tight turnaround, we didn't start careers from that one perfect feature script that took us 20 years to do. And while we were doing another job, we learned you've got 30 seconds to come up with 5 minutes of content that you have to do now. You're going on air tomorrow. So it's a kind of the water or the creator will fit any vessel that it gets dunked into. And of course it wants to be just an ocean or a river and do whatever it wants forever. But as soon as there's structure, we do fit. And I think that that's the sort of, you're digging the ditch. Just dig the ditch.
I'd love to hear about how you guys have done, how your paths have worked in tandem with each other and then joined forces occasionally, because if radio was something that you were not necessarily doing together and then you joined up, what's that process look like? And I know that, Eliza, you've studied performance, and what were you doing while Eliza was studying performance? I want to know, just give me the top line, like how your paths have run in tandem and complemented each other and then become one.
It began in the 90s.
Yep.
It did. Oh, yes, gorgeous. We've got an Aries and a Pisces. But essentially, after high school, I went to acting school for 3 years, and you went to...
I went to UTS and did media production.
Complimentary.
Which is sort of a, if you don't know it, a sort of production-y, media-y degree.
Yeah, media and production.
Oh.
If I could break break this down for you. It's a pretty complicated concept.
We have international listeners. But also Hannah's short film, which is like their final year project, where you had to make a film that was 7 minutes and under. That got into Trotfest for Hannah, and she was the youngest ever. And
Eliza was the leading lady.
So while Hannah's film is at Trotfest, I'm at acting school, Hannah's still at uni, and all the while we're doing radio and...
And you're doing radio, are you still doing 1 a.m. to 6 a.m?
No! No, we're doing drive by that point.
It was pretty funny, like, hopping around from different time slots, because we were first doing 1 till 6 a.m, and then we got bumped up from the midnight to 3 a.m. slot. And we're like, we've made it!
And it was called the midnight show, and we were like, woo!
Yes! And then, then we went to afternoons, and then we did Saturday mornings, so kind of jumped around different time slots for a couple of years at FBI.
When you guys were doing that, because I remember what it was like to do shift work in my early 20s, were you just like sleeping when you could, going to class, doing the show through the night? Like, was that a difficult slog to do the till 6 a.m? Or how often were you doing it?
We weren't doing it every night. We were doing it like once a week at tops.
You couldn't, because it's 6 hours straight, you couldn't do it. And we were DJing as well, but Dan, I'm exhausted.
I'm exhausted.
Yeah, we are such good girls, and that's something we're trying to really, obliterate before I turn 30.
Yeah.
But we would not go to, even though it would be like a Saturday 1 till 6, everyone would just be pushed through, like stay out to a party, but we were living together at home, and we would go to bed at 6 p.m. and wake up at like 10 p.m. Why didn't we just go to the party?
We should have just stayed out.
But then by 6 a.m.
just ruined.
We would really take it. We took it really, really seriously, and we were so...
We take everything very seriously.
We're so excited. It's like, we don't want to go to a party till 6 a.m. We want to like work. We want to like create, and we want to... We want to desperately to start our careers.
Yeah.
Well, definitely. There's something in that, because while you were doing that, I was pushing through. I was at the party till midday. I was, you know.
And look at us at the same bloody table. I'm curious, Jen.
But I also think that, like, there's a latency to my aptitude towards success, because I had to try everything else first. Until I was like, oh, wait a minute, I guess smashing it every weekend and achieving your dreams are not totally conducive to each other. And I had to find that balance where I literally had to leave Melbourne because the pull to the nightlife was so strong for me.
Yeah.
And I had people like, well, do you ever think about what your life would be like if you were still in Melbourne? I'd be like, I'd still be at Revolver and I'd be talking about my dreams.
talking about the
things that I was going to make and everything I was going to do and how this year was going to be my year. And there's a parallel universe version of me that is getting smashed every weekend and talking about all the things that they're going to do.
Yeah. I'm sure he'd be happy.
That's like a Russian doll situation.
He's having a great time. And I go deathbed thoughts when I'm thinking about it.
Yeah.
Having had a good 10 years worth of that.
Yeah.
And then thinking about what the other could look like.
Yeah.
And then the decision to come to Sydney at like 28 was like, yeah, I've done that for 10 years. Yeah. So I think it's a good idea to now go towards the other thing. So you guys did the your parallel universe version was you just played it safe.
Dude.
And did the right thing.
I remember when being like, it would be some Saturday night, be like, well, let's have a bottle of wine while we do it. Or something like, and we wouldn't even take the alcohol into the studio because it was like not allowed liquids in the studio. Like it was a volunteer radio station. With like,
we might spill something on the control deck.
I know, we were just like so, that was our fun to actually play so in that way.
Safe, clean fun.
How did these wayward bohemian parents breed such astute, controlling girls?
God. Well, it swings and roundabouts, isn't it? You want to rebel against what your parents have done.
I would say that they are not.
We're all A-type.
Dad is like, it's the sort of 15 minutes early, you're on time, and on time, you're late. And sometimes that's really embarrassing when you turn up to parties and the host isn't even ready. Like, I remember it's a little girl being like, Dad, no, why do we have to be here for 5 hours? Like, yeah, Dad is an incredible businessman in his own way, but he just keeps those things about, I don't know. It was just always the his punctuality is unbelievable.
But yeah. The way, I mean, I watched you guys cook a meal last night and I literally said, that was one of the best meals of my life. It was an in-depth smorgasbord of about five key dishes based around a barramundi, and then there was like three or four other accompaniments. And look, the weight of my heart is through my stomach anyway. However, just seeing the ballet of discussion and exchange that led to a restaurant quality meal being prepared by the two of you guys, and I was like, this is the genius at work. This is the this is the way in which you. Someone pushes, someone pulls. Have you got this? Yes, no, I want that. What do you... So I have a feeling that language around contributing to a joint project from different sides, working with your specialties, would serve you across the board through many of your projects, not just creating a beautiful meal.
You are very observant. And
well, I really don't want to break any sort of illusion of that's how...
What?
That's how it all works all the time, of like... But I think that's so nice of you to say. I think in terms of
cooking, just on a side note,
I'm really not confident. So I'm just like, I'll do whatever you need and I'll learn. But like, I'm not naturally a confident cook.
But I think one of the themes that will come up in this discussion, and I'm sure, and usually the themes only really appear to me retrospectively, but. That is that when, because of that very idea, you're not much of a cook, Hannah.
Yeah.
Eliza, you've got it covered. But between you have the power of two people who can make the most of Eliza's confidence, but duplicate your ability to amplify how effective you can work as a machine. One person only needs to know enough of what to do, and even the confidence of knowing that your partner in crime is along for the ride, is enough to get it across the line. And as long as you've got good language and communication and ability to compartmentalize steps of the process, there's nothing you really can't achieve together.
Yeah, actually, that's kind of true in terms of, I guess, in terms of the different study backgrounds that we've had and the different ways that we, I guess, have initially approached our creative process. Eliza coming from a performance background and Mika sort of coming from a media and production background and a directing background, they have sort of, well, they've absolutely intersected and we've both taught each other a lot.
Yeah, so
our different experiences.
When we started working in TV and it was, we were doing more and more stuff. I would be going to Hannah for questions about how to speak to a director of photography or a cinematographer, and Hannah would come to me for questions, how do you speak to actors? And we would be really good at being able to... I'd never worked...
By the time we were doing Growing Up Gracefully, Eliza had been in acting school for 3 years and I'd been directing...
TV at the ABC for
a couple of years, and so it was kind of the perfect time to sort of cross.
Yeah, the first TV I ever directed was just on the day, and I was lucky enough to at that point have a crew around me that knew my experience level, but was really excited to help me through it. And the cinematographer was so nice. So it was very like learning on the job. I feel like I have so much skill and language and structure about how to work with talent and how to make them, how to, you know, get the best out of what's in the frame as well.
Yeah.
So, Hannah, how did you first start directing? What was your entry into that space?
Can I do a brag for Hannah, because I know she won't do it herself? Hannah was working on a show called The Checkout on the ABC.
My brother's favourite show, actually.
Oh, really? Yeah. It's like a cool... It's kind of like an Andy Ruins Everything sort of consumer affairs show. And Hannah went from intern... So an intern to series director in 2 seasons. So less than
two days.
Yeah, in 2 days. And I think that was...
I just walked in with an intern badge and I just ripped it off. And yeah. I was like, rolling.
Yeah. And so she...
I got this, mate.
Yeah, exactly. And that comes from Hannah's ability to do what she does. But it also comes from, you know, the ABC and that show at the time recognizing that Hannah was up for it and gave her the support that she needed. But I can see these... older cameramen and soundies that have been at the ABC for like 40 years suddenly turning around and be like, can you get me a coffee? And she's like, and rolling? Like, and they were a bit like, what's going on? Hannah did incredibly well.
But that's fantastic, but also so interesting because everyone would dream of that possibility. What allowed that to take place? Did you apply yourself to such a degree, being the very best intern, that then another opportunity became available for a different role, and then slowly it grew.
I really did work my ass off as a runner to an insane degree that I was stressing myself out so much. I was like eating like a prison row inmate in the toilet. Like it was, and being a runner on a TV show that has, let's say, a constricted budget. It's, you're not just a runner, like you are wardrobe, your makeup, your location, catering. You are sometimes directing, you are casting, you're 10 different jobs. Instead of one job that you get to do well, you do 10 jobs very badly. But it was great to be able to get a sort of ground floor lay of the land of how a show works on a day-to-day basis. And I think
You just didn't leave work.
Yeah, and I think just because, I mean, the people who were running the show could really see that I wanted a trajectory and I wanted to learn and I was really keen to just, yeah, absorb as much as I could, then it just became more useful than, you know, hiring someone who had never been on the show than to just elevate me from within.
Did you, were you being very vocal about were you asking questions to the producers and directors about how they do what they do?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And some of the directors who were working on that show when I first started were really great at allowing me to ask whatever questions or even contribute. And yeah, some of the cameramen there were so lovely at sort of taking me aside and being like, so the reason why we're doing this shot is because of this, and kind of talking me through it, because they could see that I had such a passion for learning all that kind of stuff.
I wonder whether, because it's a small scale show on a small channel,
yeah.
And it was like, it's a favorite and it really punches above its weight. My brother owns it on DVD, like loves it.
So good.
But at the same time, it was probably a good one for people. Like if you were doing, I don't know, the most popular show on TV that was award winning, you'd be a much smaller cog in the machine. Yeah. And maybe people would be more defensive with their territory because they're thinking, well, I don't want you to take my role as director but maybe everyone here is just, they're just jobbing directors and producers doing their thing. So if some enthusiastic junior burger is asking lots of questions, you're not really defensive of the territory.
Totally, yeah, that's what it was.
That, doing our first couple of gigs in these environments of very short on time, short on people, and very do-it-yourself, constricted, a typical kind of Australian budget, usually for TV, that has absolutely been our sort of asset when we are now in the States. And that, you know, sometimes you can get very saddened because you're not making any money, you're working really, really hard, and sometimes it feels like you can't possibly succeed with the restrictions that you have. But then now, because there aren't many people, it is a do-it-yourself. It's like, well, who's going to do it? You better do it. And now being able to say that we've been able to have that experience overseas, like we would definitely still be assistants in the States.
Mm.
We would be someone's assistant somewhere. Someone's assistant's assistants. And now we can come in and say, no, we've run our own show. And they don't understand that we don't get like paid as much as they do to do it. They don't see that. Oh, except when they listen to this right now. But yeah, that's been a really amazing, now it feels like a complete gift, that sort of,
yeah, definitely like trial by fire.
Yeah, style of volunteer radio, volunteering just your time and
working. Being a bigger fish in a small pond.
Exactly. Away, so, it does.
Thanks,
yeah.
San Pellegrino.
Oh. Cheers.
Cheers.
Oh, it gets better. How does it get
better? I know. Effervescent. I was interested in the idea of, so in terms of our origin story timeline, radio together, drama school for 3 years, media production for 3 years, directing in that space and starting to clock up your experience and confidence and language around working in that space. And then how did the first show, Growing Up Gracefully, come to fruition?
Growing Up Gracefully was in development limbo for about four years.
Something like that.
So we pitched it when we were 19 and 20, while we were still doing radio.
And how did you know to pitch it? As in, like, did you apply to a funding opportunity for young up-and-comers, or were you just going into the ABC and appealing for money alongside Rake.
We had a producer. We had a producer who had heard us on radio, and that was the same producer who asked us if we were interested in developing something for television. We pitched them five or so ideas, and they picked Growing Up Gracefully as the one that they took to the ABC. And the ABC took the pitch and thought, I don't know about girls just yet, and then like put on a shelf, and it was on the shelf somewhere for three or four years, and then just kind of out of the blue one day.
We moved on. We created and we moved on.
Sheila's
we created so many other shows that Yarramadoon.
Yeah.
So we
and just, then just one day out of the blue, we received
an email
being like, congratulations, just letting you know, Growing Up Gracefully has been greenlit for 2017 and should be going into production in X date. Eliza and I were just like,
I called Hannah. I was like, what does that mean? Because we'd heard so many yeses that we never believe a yes.
Yeah.
We do not believe anyone who comes up to us in a hallway and says, we're so excited about it. It's definitely
you're
happening.
Just like, cool.
We go, thank you so much. I believe you believe that.
Yeah.
But I can't believe that until I'm and holding the DVD like your brother.
You just get used to that pattern when it's like, we're so close. It's definitely going to happen. And then it's like, okay, well, it's not, but it's definitely going to happen now. It happened. That process happened about, 10 times over the course of 4 years or so. But yeah, then we just received an email saying it had been greenlit. And it honestly took us about 3 months to pluck up the courage to reread the pitch document that we had given the ABC. Because we were just like, what show are we doing? Oh my God.
It was the first thing that I had ever written ever. And I was like 20.
We were kind of just like, okay, we're doing a show about etiquette. Let's do this.
So it feels like that. But that has kind of that time of that, say like 3 or 4 years that we waited for Growing Up Gracefully to get, we were just like, when we're going to grow up by the time it's done.
We'll be like 40. Like,
yeah, exactly. We will be, I'll be pregnant and we'll be like, oh God.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it did finally happen, but we had already been working on Yarramadoon that became the Belvoir musical and Sheila's, which became this big thing through Screen Australia. We were already doing that while we were waiting for Growing Up Gracefully, but we weren't even waiting. We just moved on. We were just like, let it. But then, so it feels like over the last 2 years, or suddenly it feels like everything's happening all at once, but it has been quite a long time to develop them all, I guess.
The pattern that has seemed to develop and that has kind of become a little bit reassuring in my mind anyway, is that it's kind of like you have to sort of like farm your career. You spend a lot of time like hoeing and planting and you're like, there's nothing happening. It's just dirt. It's all dirt for miles. All of a sudden, out of nowhere,
Hannah's really showing how her farming agricultural skills.
I was formulating an agriculture based analogy in my mind.
Stop
as you were saying that because
we're digging ditches, babe.
Because we're digging ditches, but no, the exact same thing. Because every now and then,
digging ditches.
Dude, anyone who's lifted a shovel is going to look at us with just such disdain now.
You guys are from a rural.
We are. Yes, we are. Rural. Yes, we are. Yes, we are.
Cows around.
Yes.
Yes. You country girl.
I'm yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Too in my town. Yeah. Yeah.
Salt of the Lions.
Yeah.
I was thinking, I would love you to finish your point. And,
yeah.
And at the time you were about to say that, I was thinking the same thing. Because every now and then someone was like, oh, wow, you're doing so much. And you're just thinking, well, you're kind of looking at the last 2 years and everything is just, for whatever reason, has become ready to post or ready to share. And it looks like I'm really fecund with my process at
right
the moment, but all you're seeing is just the 3 or 4 seasons finally on show.
Yeah,
that is the kind of half the job is doing the job, and the other half is this mythology that you have to upkeep for the job. I don't know why. I don't even know if it's helpful, but you do feel a pressure to kind of.
Do you think in terms of the optics around the, like when you say mythology is in terms of the life that you're living and
definitely
the mythology of, say, for the last year, over the past 12 months, me and Hannah have not been in anything front facing. So we haven't been in a play, we haven't been on the screens, we haven't done that. And there is that pressure of, well, how can we accommodate that mythology of, because people kind of don't, people think that if you're not in it, you're not doing anything. So you kind of have to sort of it's a very private and insular process, creation. And it's, you know, you do it in a dark room alone and just very privately and quietly. So then you have to facilitate the other stuff, which is kind of being present and making sure that your audience knows that you're still there and that you love them and that you can't wait to show them the next thing. So I guess that's the maybe mythology is the wrong word.
Mythology's big. Like, it's, I mean...
You reckon? What do you reckon a better word is about that?
Lie?
Lying?
No, well, like I mean, it's the optics. It's the
optics, sorry.
It's the way in which you're sort of, yeah, it's also the presentation of the, yeah, I think the mythology makes perfect sense to me.
Lying. No, it's not lying. It's about being like, there's a new season launch of a brand. Like, everyone's been really hard at work. That doesn't mean that the fashion brand just falls over. You're still selling your product. You're still making sure that people are excited.
There's got to be something in the shop window at all times, basically.
That's a really good way. There's got to be something in the shop window.
At all times. But it's true. It's true, because no matter what month of the year production is at its highest,
yeah,
you're constantly rolling out the season of in
yes, mm, yeah,
yeah, it's true,
and making people feel like that they can still bank on us when we do provide the next thing that we're so excited to show them.
So you guys are in a process now where you've done a few ABC series that are not narrative based. They were, how do you describe that?
Entertainment. Docu comedy.
Some people call them docu comedy. Some people call them infotainment space.
Yeah. But the way the ABC classifies it is entertainment.
I call what I do inspotainment.
Woo! Love that.
Yeah, it's true. Simultaneously inspired.
I have totally, yeah.
And but what were you guys now? So talk to me about your dipping your toe into the pool of the US, because when you're a young creative filmmaker or so many art forms, the US is just the promised land. Mm-hmm. So what is it about the call to be working over there? What opportunities present themselves, you know, in terms of what you dreamed they could be, and what has the reality been like that you've discovered in going over there so far?
We went to the US for my first time, and as an actor, there always is that pressure of, you're going to go over for pilot season first year out of acting school or second year, or you need to start going over there year after year to get those relationships building. And I didn't go because I was like, I think that I'll have a better chance of impact over there if I have something to take over. And, you know, if I just got a job in Home and Away straight out of acting school, I might not be doing what I'm doing now, but no one gives you a gig. I still, like, people, you know, you still struggle to get gigs as an actor. Now it's because people don't think I want to be in anything that's not my own. But, so we went to the US, Screen Australia. We were really lucky that Screen Australia took us over to the US last year. And that was through this big, amazing, what is it called?
Talent LA.
I know, but what is it called when you go on like a delegation? Like, yeah. And so we had a like 10 days full of massive jam-packed meetings and lectures and workshops.
It was honestly
bonkers.
Like a university education in the American showbiz system.
Yeah.
When you say meetings, to give context, what was it that you guys had been doing that then allowed Australian Australia to go? So it was off the strength of the shows?
They ask you to put together a pitch, which is basically trying to justify to them why you're at a point in your career that this is kind of essential and beneficial and that you're ready to kind of take this next step. And that for us would have been, yeah, off the back of Growing Up Gracefully in Sheila's, and we put together a slate of pitches that we wanted to start talking to US producers about, which we did when we went over there, and
current projects that we had on the boil.
And I guess like what our objectives would be when we went to the US, and for us that was to sign with US reps and to, I guess,
start the ball rolling on one of our projects,
yeah,
which we did, and more.
It was great. Yeah.
But Screen Australia are incredibly supportive, but they really demand excellence and specificity with, if they're going to give you this opportunity, what are you going to do with it? And you have to come through and you have to prove it. And so we worked really hard on our application, and we were definitely the least experienced of the whole delegation, who they were amazing people to learn with and work with ourselves. Mm. We had some amazing, like, beautiful Greg Waters was there, and he...
Former guest of this podcast.
Exactly. And he was amazing at kind of... at intimidating cocktail parties, giving us a little bit of a shove and being like, come on, you can do it. Go speak to that person. Go on, you can do it. And he was very encouraging, as was everyone. So that started our journey into the US, and we had 40 meetings.
Oh, it was mental.
4 weeks.
And the meeting to just determine whether people would like to work with you or see more of what
you're It was basically generals. And so a general is basically like a first date. It's... Yeah. But it can change from person to person. For some generals, they just want to have a coffee with you and get to know you as a person. And it's basically to figure out, say, if you're a producer and I'm a writer, whether we'd want to be in a room together.
For 14 hours a day for 8 years.
Yeah, exactly. And for other people, for other producers, they would basically sit down and be like, all right, what have you got? And really want you to pitch straight off the bat. And so it was kind of this amazing experience where we really had to be on our toes at all times, really read the vibe constantly of what people would want from you. And it was incredibly nerve-wracking at first. Like,
especially
when
you're having like 8 coffees from 8 different offices.
We were just like shaking and getting in and out of Ubers. And but it was great. And honestly... I mean, we kind of expected to go over there and maybe have some experiences that people sort of warn you about in Hollywood and LA, that people would kind of be talking themselves up in a way that wasn't realistic, or that you'd meet some kind of like dodgy characters or whatever. We had completely the opposite experience, where every single person that we met with was incredibly generous, hospitable, so open with all of their information, and so encouraging and inspiring. But we just kind of went away being like, oh my God, the way that the system works over there and just the general attitude is pretty different to the Australian showbiz system, which is obviously wonderful, but can be very cynical, really, really cynical. And there's a reason for that.
You're just talking about energy, the energy of the people that you meet sometimes.
Yes, and there is a huge reason for that, because it's a huge slog to get anything made in Australia, and there are so many obstacles to making the kind of work that creators often want to make. And there is an element to the Hollywood system where that kind of positivity can also be seen as like a little bit, like a certain percentage of bullshit, and the rest is sincere positivity. But regardless... when you're there, you are truly inspired and energized, and the idea, like just the idea generation, you'll sit down with someone and just have a conversation and you'll come away with 10 different ideas. And it was just, for us, it was kind of a bit of a game changer of forming a model of where we wanted to be and how we wanted to work.
And also sitting as a creator in Australia, LA or Hollywood is very far away. It's a very removed idea. It doesn't exist in a way. And then suddenly within 12 hours notice, sitting across from your person who you've been watching on TV or that you are genuinely really inspired by, like sitting across and just having a chat, it's very tangible.
So I imagine also very empowering, because you realize just how real this whole thing is, as opposed to being, because Hollywood is a fantasy in so many ways, but then when you realize it's a jobbing kind of, it's like a Mercedes town in Germany, you know, it's just like, it's a factory city.
Yeah, it totally is. And there's so much propaganda around Hollywood that's been going for 100 years or so. Yeah, it was really, it made us look back at Australia very, very grateful for having, you know, done the things that we do, and we're really inspired to make more things here now.
The blessing and the curse of what we've described is Australia great, because it's given you an opportunity to be big fish in a smaller pond and elevate your careers faster. And then the downside is, because it is smaller, there's less opportunity. There's sort of a cynical, maybe holding cards closer to your chest. Totally. Someone who has the power and doesn't want to release it, it's less likely to let someone, you know, have their opportunities potentially. I'm really impressed with what I understand of the way you guys work in a practical day-to-day way. So right now, does your does your day-to-day look like turning up and going somewhere to do a job, or do you work in your own space creatively and independently? What does your work practice look like at the moment?
I guess we've been experimenting over the last couple of months with mixing things up. And when we got back from the States, because we had a lot of work to deliver to the Americans that we promised we would give work, we started to do this thing that I think is based on what Shonda Rhimes' method of waking up at 6 a.m. and writing from 6 a.m. until 10 a.m. and that's like no Wi-Fi, no distractions, just you and the blank page. And then from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. is like the rest of the hustling day, where you do all your emails, you do all your phone calls, you do all your sort of business admin.
You do your shop window set dressing.
Sure. Yes, exactly. Who came up with that analogy? So smart. And so we did that for a little while, and that was really effective because it really sort of makes you put your head down. You have to go to bed early, and you really... And it's also great because it focuses your writing time into those hours, and you're not allowed to write outside of them. So it motivates you to come to the table the next day.
The deal is you're not allowed to do anything creative or, you know, romantic or writing or dreaming outside of those hours. So sometimes we'd be together and Hannah would be like, oh, I've got a great idea. I was like, burr, burr. Like you have to wait till the next day. And actually putting a restriction on that turned it kind of into a love affair of I can't wait till 6 a.m. tomorrow so I can actually get it down because it's been in my head all day and I can't write it. Like it puts restriction around it so it becomes very romantic and fun.
How did you hold on to the idea? Did you have to take a note to make sure that you
just write it down on my phone.
You write it down.
Lots of notes on my phone. If I die, can someone please just put my phone in an incinerator? Like, don't look at the voice memos or notes. So we tried that for a little while, which was really effective. And then we sort of... It really just depends what is on our plate at the time.
Like, we just finished doing a writer's room with our next project with, like, 7 other amazing women going into... So that is more than full-time in terms of you do your normal day. And then because we're executive producers of it, therefore then you do all the business stuff from outside of those hours. So then it kind of changes and you have to be incredibly, like most people on your podcast, incredibly flexible with your time, have a routine, but then get ready to throw it out the window at any moment's notice and then get ready to go back to it.
As far as the Shonda technique, you got, 6 till 10 is... creative romantic work.
Mm-hmm.
10 till 2 is visual merchandising for the shop windows.
Yes.
From 2 p.m. are you a free agent?
The idea is, well, Shonda would then go to do a 16-hour day or whatever she would do, but the idea is that, you know, how can you create when you don't have a wife, really? And so the idea is from 2 p.m. onwards, that's free time. You get to connect with your friends, with your family, which we have trouble doing, you know, having friends. Well, like you go out, you're seeing the world, you're getting that stuff that can come into your brain to be able to sleep on. But then most, I'm afraid that you're working till 8 p.m. You know what I mean? Like we go in 2 p.m. we'll stop, and then suddenly another thing will happen and... It's been hard for us to kind of call it.
And that's you going back to responding to emails or needing to put a pitch together or doing something relating to the business of what you're doing that calls on creative tools, but you're not script writing. You're still running your business.
Yes.
Okay. It's good for me to know because I had heard the Shonda technique and I was just thinking, how practically could I make that work for myself? And I think I could do it too, but I'm just at the mercy of...
Yeah,
3 or 4 different clients who might need something random, and then new opportunities come up and you're like, oh, I need to put a pitch in for this thing, and that's my 2 p.m. onwards would be that time.
Well, why don't you try it just for 2 hours or 45 minutes? Like 4 hours is
a lot.
4 hours is a lot, and it was the time that we needed to actually get through the deadlines that we had. And so Shonda, when she's running 3 or 4 shows, she needs 4 hours of writing every day to get through her workload. But just even 45 minutes of... And the deal is, like, even if you're just looking at a blank screen for 4 hours, that's all you're doing. You were just sitting there, and it doesn't... There's no obligation or expectation about what you're going to have at the end of that time. You just have to spend that time.
It's ideation as good as...
Yeah, that's the promise you make yourself. So you're like, there's no expectation, there's no obligation. All right, fine, I'll just write something really bad. So maybe you could try it for like 45 minutes instead of 4 hours.
I think even a tidy hour. No, I've got an hour in my day that's just mine for creative process before I give the world my energy. That could work.
Yeah.
So where? What's next? When I love to end by asking my guests, if I was to bump into you in a year's time, what is a project that's currently gestating or, you know, in its development stages that would potentially make you very proud to say you've completed in a year?
Completed.
Well, or be well on the road.
Be well on the road, yes. Yeah. Okay. Well, there's this project that we just came out of a writer's room, which is the first project that we'll be making under our production company that's a dramedy.
I hope with that project by next year, this time next year, it is...
in development.
What time is it? No, what month is it?
It's July.
It's okay, July. Right.
By July next year, I would love to have something getting ready to shoot. So we're in pre-production for something. Right now, it could be either one... it could be one of three projects at the moment that are almost like we might be getting into production next year.
You're just waiting for the green light from a funding perspective to let you know what that would be?
And strategy.
Yeah.
A strategy about what do we... do we go for the project in the US? Do we stay at home and do
this? A lot of those... forces outside of our control.
Exactly. Like, yeah, exactly.
Like in so many different times in our career, we're keeping things on the boil and generating projects, but also there's things that we just need to wait for like the hand of fate to come in and decide whether we want to take that opportunity or whether we keep going with the one that we've got. But yeah, there's one specific project that is the two of us, and we'd be writing it and the like co-stars and producing it, which I think we're both really excited about. It's a really kind of really interesting dramedy that I think we'd both be really keen to sink our teeth into.
But for a year, if you look back, yeah. In a year, that project.
I mean, in terms of the projects that we're doing together.
And your solo show?
Oh, well, yeah, I've been doing a solo comedy show that I really love, but I'm also writing a musical, a musical at the moment that I'm going to be... doing a showcase of in like April next year, which is kind of scary. But
for those who are, I don't even think I stopped to ask, because the idea of just like, I'm just writing a musical along, like I'm a director and a producer, but I'm just writing a musical. But writing a musical is a very specific skill set. How do you know how to write a musical?
I don't.
Are you a musical person?
I don't know how to read or write music, but I
woke up like this, okay?
Yeah, I think it's just
I would say that you know how to write a musical in the same way that sort of Trey Parker and Matt Stone know how to write a musical.
Yeah, it's just like an instinct. It's like if you know... it's basically just figuring out what the premise of the song is and knowing enough musical references that would be able to best serve that what you're trying to say in that song. And that's it. Like, I don't know... I mean, obviously, that's not it, but that's all I can do.
I've seen your one-woman show, which is an adaptation, which is telling the story of yourself as... there's a youth radio station called Triple J, and Hannah is the... you had a job as the
sexpert.
The sexpert. The sex... call in, tell us your problems, and she'll give you some sex.
Despite having the worst love life of anyone that I knew.
And that is the subject of a one-woman stand-up comedy show.
Yeah.
And which is full of not just music that sounds lovely to listen to, but jams that if they were... if you saw the musical... do you know my problem with modern day musicals is you'll go and see one, but you don't have anything sticking in your head for a few days after.
Yeah. Oh, so you've got to wake up and go to sleep with it in your head.
I want to hear, you know, like the real Bring the House Down number in the shower for the following month.
Yeah.
And I was humming your tunes to myself for days afterwards. Nice. So I want to know, like, yeah, what was the... like, how did you decide that... writing that musical was going to then be... or where did it come from, and how did it end up going to a one-woman show?
I think just having a couple of years distance after doing this experience where I was like somehow fell into this job of giving people sex and relationship advice, like hundreds of thousands of people on radio every Sunday night, sex and relationship advice, whilst having no idea what I was doing, zero qualifications, and... being in that role and being told that you need to be this thing and having to try and step up to whatever plate that is and all the weird situations. It's basically about not like being too scared to be your authentic self and actually being beholden to other people's expectations of you. And it was just such a weird experience that I was like, oh, this needs to be something. And I wrote it up as a television pitch. It didn't quite work. And it was actually Eliza who suggested that I do it into a show. And I was like, oh, that totally makes sense. And yeah, so it just kind of came from there.
It's a joy to watch.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you so much for coming to have a chat, guys.
Thank you for having us.
We've just covered so much ground.
Thank you for the company. Thank you for the questions.
The sand pearl.
Thanks for the sparkling sand pearl. Thanks for the trip to the Amalfi Coast. That is.
I'm so excited to finally be on the podcast that I've been listening to and getting some creative juice. I feel like this is probably just going to turn into like a big family stew because like I've learnt lessons from the podcast that I probably digested and now regurgitating in a different way. I'm probably stealing stuff from Flex Mommy. Sorry, girl. You know what I mean? So it's going to turn into this pool.
She's lucky I haven't killed her and resumed her life. I'm obsessed by her.
She's gorgeous. Process.
But that's the joy of doing this podcast. I get so much better. I'm hoping to vampirically suck the knowledge from my guests the way Madonna killed Britney Spears when she kissed her.
Yes, you can smooch us on the lips anytime.
And then Missy Elliott's going to come down and say, yes. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.